We get to make wines that are going to be different every single year because of what Mother Nature throws at us.
You're really in touch with the seasons.
This is farming. Where this all starts is agriculture.
Wine is both a representation of its place and a representation of its time.
We can't control Mother Nature.
To make really fine wine, you need to do it in the old traditional way.
It was a lot funkier back then than it is now.
We are in a creative kind of business, and so this is what makes it fun.
I really love what I do. I'm happiest, I think, when I'm in the vineyard.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle. And welcome to podcast number 156. This week, we feature Aaron Pott of Pott Wine, Napa Valley.
This is going to be a fun interview. I said that to myself before talking with winemaker Aaron Pott, and I was able to relive that fun during the edit. Aaron is silly, serious, not serious, very intelligent, passionate, and most of all, an easy guy to talk to. After working through complicated schedules, we were finally able to catch up with Aaron at Quixote Winery in the Stags Leap district of Napa Valley in June of this year. If you don't finish this podcast with a smile on your face, you weren't listening. We have a chorus in the background. Here we are at Quixote, and we are here with Aaron Pott, winemaker extraordinaire, if I can say that. Wonderful winemaker who we've been trying to meet up with for a long time. Aaron, how are you today?
I'm well, thanks. How are you, Ray?
I'm fabulous. Thank you for being here. Thank you for taking the time. And we finally did this. We finally pulled it off.
It's been a while. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Dinners were planned.
Yeah. Well, we can hold you to that one day.
Yeah, I hope so.
I guess one of my first questions is, where are you from originally, Aaron?
Eugene, Oregon.
Really?
Yes.
And that's not far away from some pretty prime wine country.
Yeah, it wasn't wine country when I was from there, but it is wine country now.
Yeah. And, you know, for you, your own particular wine path, I mean, were you raised in a family that enjoyed wine? Was it, did you find your path some other way?
I was raised in a family that enjoyed wine, yes, but my father was a Presbyterian minister. And so that's not quite the direct path to winemaking that you would think. We had wine for lunch, for dinner, and we also had wine that was poorly stored in the house, and sometimes bottles would self-open on hot days.
Nice. Well, those were miracles, weren't they, something like that?
Yes.
Obviously, you know, you're making wine for a number of different people, but how did you end up, did you just like anybody else enjoy alcohol, spirits?
I was first really introduced to wine and really knew that that was my calling. When I was 9 years old, my parents took me to Paris for the first time, and I ordered a glass of milk in a very eminent bistro in Paris. And the waiter looked at me and he said, "Milk is for babies." And he brought me a glass of wine. And at that moment I thought, this is what's going to make me an adult. This is the beverage that will move me from being a child to an adult. And during that trip, we visited a lot of wine regions, and I saw people that were living their life outside, that had these wonderful chateaux that they were living in, that had dogs that were running in vineyards. And I thought, this is a great life. And I always kept that in my mind, that wine was the thing that would make me an adult. Still hasn't worked, but I'm trying to get there.
Nine's kind of a early point to have that lightning bolt hit you, isn't it?
Yeah, it was like the Annunciation or something, you know. It came out of the sky, and it hasn't left. The excitement is still there.
Well, we're all lucky for that. We appreciate that.
Yes, good.
So, I mean, so this was seriously something you thought you want to find out how this is made and how it gets done.
Yeah, and it was made possible by the fact that I found out that you could go to university and study winemaking. And so immediately I went to do that and study winemaking at school. I did an undergraduate degree in enology. I did a graduate degree in viticulture at the Université de Bourgogne in France, and was on my way.
You spent some time working over there as well, correct?
Yes, yeah. I worked for almost 6 years in Saint-Emilion in Bordeaux, so working with Merlot, Cabernet Franc mainly, on the right bank, and was much before I should have been made the winemaker at a illustrious chateau called Trolamondo.
Wow. Did you ever have thought of just staying there, not coming back?
Often, yeah. Yes. Yeah, very often. And I'm happy that I didn't at this point.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
After coming back here to Napa Valley, so much of what I loved about France appeared here. And so much of what I love about wine happens in the Napa Valley. And it's really, for me, my home. I love to go to France. I love the French language. I love all things French. But for me, wine, and especially great wine made from Bordeaux varietals, is really here in Napa Valley.
The weather's heck of a lot better, too.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, you don't even know. Every vintage that I had in Saint-Emilion, we were forced to pick the grapes before they were ripe because of weather coming in.
Wow. You must have just chewed your fingernails off.
Yes. But learned a lot. I mean, it was an incredible learning experience where you're working with very challenging vintages. It makes California seem very easy.
Hard to even think about that. I mean, you certainly have weather challenges here, but it's just not the same thing.
No, not at all.
So when you came back to the States, where did you go?
Well, funnily enough, I dropped off quite easily into California because I took a job with Beringer, working as what I called the International Winemaker of Mystery. And I was running Beringer's overseas programs, and they had winemaking operations in Chile, in Argentina, in Italy, and in France. And so I ran all of their projects overseas.
And then from there?
And then from there, Beringer changed quite a bit when Foster's bought the group. And somebody in the Australian world decided that my 11th century Castello outside of Florence in Chianti looked very appealing, and so they decided to take it over. And that diminished my job a little bit. And so the people at Beringer decided to give me another position as a reward. And so that reward was St. Clement Vineyards in St. Helena, mm-hmm. in Napa Valley. And so I started in 2001 doing that, as well as continuing those overseas projects. And St. Clement was my first introduction back to Napa Valley after having worked in the very early 90s as a winemaker at Newton Vineyards, assistant to John Consgard. So I came back and worked three vintages at St. Clement, 2001, 2, and 3, and then moved on to Quintesso Winery as the general manager winemaker there.
It's interesting in a way you kind of make me think a little bit about John Adams when he was sent across the ocean to France and to England, and and then you come back and, you know, of course, you really didn't start in the Valley, so you weren't coming back to the same thing. But, you know, having worked in France, and other than the idea that maybe it was easier because of weather, it had to really be something to see how Napa Valley was developing at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. Coming from France, where the 90s were a very important period for technology and wine, and the right bank in Bordeaux was the focus of that technology, and then coming back to the United States, where it was such a period of growth and a period of progress in the Napa Valley, it was an amazing experience. I'm humbled and honored to be compared to John Adams. I'm a big fan of those Enlightenment thinkers that founded our country, and so much of what was part of the foundation of the United States was thought and ideas that came out of France in the 17th and 18th century. And I think for a winemaker, it's the same thing. You're being influenced by outside ideas and thought. And for me to have worked in the 90s in Saint-Emilion in the right bank, and being able to see so much of the ideas that were so important to wine and would become so important to wine, and being able to work in that environment was something that changed my life. And I think probably, you know, Thomas Jefferson or John Adams, when they were over there and read Voltaire or Rousseau, they probably felt the same way, that this was life-changing.
What an education going over there. Yeah, I can't imagine what they went through, especially considering what it took just to get there. Just the whole idea of traveling back and forth. You know, we take that for granted these days, don't we? The Napa Valley today is not the Napa Valley back then. And a lot of good things, as I see it, have happened, and certainly a lot of change in terms of tourism. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, how the change has gone on over the last 20 years?
It's a very different place. When I first came to Napa Valley, the idea of wine being a beverage that was beneficial to your health didn't exist. And it seems unreal to think of that now, but now wine is so important to the world, but to us Americans, it's been an age of discovery. The last 20 years have been a phenomenal change in how wine is perceived and how wine is thought of at the table, but also how wine people are perceived as well. I was fortunate enough to eat dinner with two of my idols in the wine world last night, John Konsgaard and John Schaefer. And seeing those two generations of wine people and how their world has changed so phenomenally. I mean, Schaefer with his James Beard Award now, and from his early days of making wine here in Napa Valley, and John Konsgaard as well, being one of the great pioneers of the modern era of Napa Valley. It's a very different world, and maybe more romantic to people than it was. But there has been a great acceptance of our alchemy in the last few years that has changed the world of wine in a big way.
What a couple of great minds to be around.
Yeah.
John is such a nice guy, John Schaefer, and having read Doug's book and talked to him, we've interviewed John a number of years ago as well as Doug. It's such a great inspiration to people as business people to see how you can succeed just by remaining calm and following the path. I mean, is that fair to say?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think John Schaefer was very fortunate enough to have a lot of people around him that knew what they were doing. And John Konsgaard was an early consultant with the Schaefers. I remember getting calls from Doug when I was working in France, and a lot of questions were there. And I think the Schaefers are people that are not afraid to ask questions, and that's what's made their legacy as a great winemaking house.
That's that Midwestern mentality.
Absolutely.
So you're making wine for different people, and you're consulting as well, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Can you tell me some of the names of the people you're making wine for?
Some of the illustrious names, Adler Deutsch Vineyard, Seven Stones, Perlis, Blackbird, Jericho Canyon Vineyards, Quixote, Santa Elena Winery.
So you're kept pretty busy. This always fascinates me, both from the actual making the wine and the consulting point of view. I mean, do you feel yourself pulled in a lot of different directions, or is that a comfortable thing for you to be that kind of busy?
It's nice to be that kind of busy. It's all of my clients are close at hand, so it's nice to be able to see what's being produced around Napa Valley, and to see different wines that are being made here, and to get to experience different wine regions and to have an influence on those wines.
I have to say, I'm a very big fan of Blackbird. You really do a beautiful job for them, I have to say.
Yeah, thank you. It's one of my favorite projects, working with varietals that I love, Cabernet Franc and Merlot. It's a youthful group of people that have very dynamic ideas. The owner, Michael Polemski, is very in the forefront of art and just thought in general. He's a very bright character. It's nice to work with people like that.
Mm. So, but here at Quixote, you're going a different direction in terms of what you're making, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Quixote is a total anomaly. I mean, you just have to come here and see the Freudenreich 100-Wasser built winery to see that it is a wacky affair here.
You could and, say wacky, yes.
Yeah. And founded by Carl Domeni, known as the Ayatollah Domeni in this area. Carl bought in the late 60s, bought Stag's Leap Winery and chunked off this piece of wonderful terroir. And he's a iconoclast and was interested in planting Petit Syrah, which is a grape he loves. He's not a big fan of Cabernet Sauvignon, which has been great for me because I've been able to steal some of his Cabernet Sauvignon to use in my own personal wines.
Nice deal.
Yeah, very good deal.
How long have you been making the wine for Quixote?
Since 2008.
And of course, on top of this, there is Aaron Pott Wine.
Yeah, Pott Wine, as it's known. Not just Aaron Pott, but Aaron and his wife Claire and his two daughters.
So it's an entire family project.
Yeah, and it really is an entire family project. I think there's a lot of made-up family projects in the wine world, but my kids, 6 years old and 8 years old, come and sort grapes. My wife is the voice of Pott Wine and also runs the business side of things, which I know nothing about, so I'm a one-trick pony. I know how to make it. I'm a good vineyard guy. But in terms of dealing with balancing the budgets and so on, I can't do that. So my wife does that for me brilliantly.
Well, you picked a good living, trust me. why are we interviewing her? We should be talking to her.
Absolutely. I think so. She's prettier than I am, and she has a better voice, too.
Well, I won't go there with the pretty thing. That's fine. I agree. The whole idea, though, of with all these other projects and doing this family project, which I didn't know was a family project, by the way, it's again, another contrast from everything else you're doing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a contrast from what we're doing. Most of what we do are blended wines. Pott Wine are wines that are very singular expressions of where they come from. There's no blending that goes on. We make wines from unique terroir, and it's almost a Burgundian concept of wine, small production, small lot wines that really show their terroir focus. And I don't take that lightly. It's kind of a very common theme in Napa Valley these days. People say that a lot. But literally, these are four-barrel lots, which is a big lot for us, four barrels. So 100 cases is a large lot for us, and they're from a single vineyard site. And so you really get to see what handcrafted wine is like. And more importantly, when you try the wines over several different vintages, you get to see the differences in those vintages because you're trying the same wine from different vintages.
So while I was switching batteries, I tossed out to the name Chester's Anvil, which is a wine I truly love, and it's very reasonably priced. And you said there's an interesting story behind how that started up.
Yeah, so Chester's Anvil is a joint venture, we like to call it a pot joint venture, with Legere Meredith Wines. And Legere Meredith was vineyard up on Mount Veeder that was started by Carol Meredith and Steve Legere. People know Carol Meredith as Dr. Carol Meredith, the famous geneticist that found most of the origins of the grape varietals. For example, Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah. I mean, I could go on. She's a very famous geneticist. And they started a winery that's mainly focused on Syrah. And they coincidentally own the property next door to ours on Mount Veeder. Carol was a professor of mine at Davis, and her husband, Steve Legere, hired me for my first real job in the wine industry as an intern at Robert Mondavi Winery.
I've heard of them.
Yeah, they're a little bit well known. Mm. So I worked with them early on, and we've remained good friends. Our respective properties have a fire road between them. That's dirt road, has no DUI checkpoints ever. It can be traversed by drunken fools at any time, day or night. And so we often found ourselves hanging out together and drinking mass quantities of wine. So fast forward to 2007, and we got a call from an eminent vineyard owner on Mount Veeder, a guy named Chester Brandlin. And Chester had a huge property on Mount Veeder that he sold to Cuvaison. And he kept a small two-acre plot. And that two-acre plot was mainly planted to Zinfandel, although it was dotted with a few different vines of Mourvèdre. Nobody knew that except for Carol Meredith, when she came out there, was able to identify those Mourvèdre vines. And Chester one day called us up on the phone and said, you know, I've got butt cancer and I need somebody to help me do my tractor work because I just can't do tractor work anymore. And so Steve and I came to the aid of a friendly neighbor and started doing work in his small vineyard on weekends. And it was just for fun. It was nice to get out there with my friend Steve. And there were a lot of unusual encounters with Chester Brandlin as well, who was a very colorful character, most of which I can't recount on radio even. But Chester, at the end of the stint, gave us each a gift. He gave Steve a 19th century anvil, and he gave me a 19th century plow. And then he also offered up his grapes for us to make wine from. So we jumped at the chance to make wine from this old Zinfandel vineyard. And in 2007, we made a wine together, and we decided to call it Chester's Anvil, after the anvil that he had given Steve, which fit in perfectly with our motto, get hammered on the anvil. Although we could have called it Chester's Plow, and then it could have been get plowed on the plow, but it just didn't have the same ring to it. So because we are good friends and liked this project, we decided to make other wines together. And it sort of blossomed into this wonderful little brand called Chester's Anvil. And it's mainly focused on one wine, which is called Hattori Hanzo. All the wines, if they're blends, are named after something to do with an anvil. And of course, Hattori Hanzo was the legendary samurai sword maker. But also the fictional character in the Quentin Tarantino film Kill Bill. Oh. Who was also a sword maker.
Right.
But so we named a blended wine after Hattori Hanzo, and that's the sort of main focus of the wines. And the wines are always very reasonably priced, always from Napa Valley, and it's mainly a blend of Bordeaux varietals and Syrah.
I don't know if this is a good question to ask, but is Chester still around?
No, Chester died, unfortunately.
That's too bad.
And he was buried next to his girlfriend, whom he made live in a trailer behind his house while he lived with his mother.
This story gets better.
Yes. I mean, I could go on.
So. Oh, my God.
A lot of amazing stories in the world of Chester Brandlin.
All the better behind the label, though, this story. And the labels are very cool. I really like them. It makes it sort of a very approachable wine.
I mean, one thing that's interesting to note about the Brandlin family is they were the original owners of Mayakamas Vineyard.
Really?
And literally owned all of Mount Veeder at the time, which is the main focus of my wines from a very difficult and unusual region in Napa Valley.
Yeah. And as far as the weather up there goes, I mean, how crazy does it get in terms of change? I mean, I've always gotten this impression it's pretty extreme.
So I have a friend that believes that Mount Veeder is cursed. That it's
well, that answered that question.
It's an unusual region. Most of the soils on the mountain are sedimentary soils. They're very old soils, which is very rare in Napa Valley. Most of the soils are quite young, 4 million years old. There are soils that are 60 million plus years of age up there. So it's a very old part of Napa Valley, sedimentary soils. It's connected to Carneros, so Carneros being sort of a Chardonnay, Pinot Noir growing region, it's a much colder region, but it's also in the mountains, so you're at high elevation. It's the area where we get the most rainfall in Napa Valley, so high amounts of rainfall in the winter. So it's a very challenging region.
And so is that part of it? Is that idea of the challenge maybe takes you a little bit back to France?
I like the limits, you know, where I make wine, I like to push the limits of where grapes ripen, because I think it's there that you get the most extreme and most exciting expressions of those grape varietals. And Mount Veeder, to me, is one of the few places in Napa Valley where you're really pushing the limits of where Bordeaux varietals ripen.
This has been great. I could keep you here all day, you know that.
I might bore you to death after a while.
No, I don't. This has been fascinating talking to you. Where would be a couple of ways for people to find out a little bit more about Aaron Pott online?
I think the best place is pottwine.com, P-O-T-T, wine, singular.com. Yeah, the wines that we make under the Pott Wine label are tough to get. You got to be anointed and sign up for the long wait on the waiting list, and have to have 3 notes from your grandmother.
Let's hope she's still alive. That makes it a lot easier. I was going to call you Chester. Sorry, it just came into my head for a moment there. Aaron, thanks very much for taking the time. It's a stunning day here at Quixote, and it's always a pleasure to chat with you.
My pleasure, Ray. Good to talk to you, too. All right, that was easy.
Learn more at pottwine.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2015.